Hello and welcome to Conker's Corner. Today I have Dr. Daniel Crosby. He's coming on to Conker's Corner all the way from the US of A. Daniel is a renowned psychologist and behavioral finance expert. He works with organizations to develop products and messaging to maximize positive investment outcomes. Now, Daniel has written a fantastic book called The Laws of Wealth, which we'll be discussing earlier. But essentially, Daniel's work is around our cognitive dissonance, our irrational behaviors, and how emotion-driven mistakes can lead to poor investments. Hello, Daniel. How are you?
Hello. Doing very well.
Now, thank you ever so much for coming on to Conker's Corner, Daniel.
Yeah, my pleasure. Absolutely.
Great, because I know you're a busy man. You're doing tours. You're running Nocturne Capital. You're writing for numerous outlets, including wealthmanagement.com and other risk management magazines and stuff like that. So thank you ever so much.
No problem. It's Christmas, 10 days to Christmas. We're slowing down quite a bit, so it's a great time.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Now, Daniel, as I do with all the individuals that I interview, I'd like to discuss with them how they started their journey towards investing or into the investing field, and also with yourself, how you became a psychologist and leaning towards behavioral finance, if I may. So, schooling, parenting, influences, etc. If you could start there for me, please.
Sure. So I grew up the son of a financial advisor. So grew up, never had a chance. So grew up very much steeped in sort of best financial practices, talk about stocks and shares at the dinner table. My dad is quite a gifted investor and a great advisor, and so was very lucky in that respect. It's funny story, debt was a four-letter word in my house, just like all of the other four-letter words. My dad literally would not let us say the word debt. So grew up, I think with some very sound principles around money, and very much immersed in that. So set out in college to be an investment manager, started out with an eye to doing business, but then midway through college, I actually dropped out and was a missionary for my church in the Philippines for a few years, teaching English, building schools, trying to do a little good in the world. And it was at that point that I became interested in a more helping profession, chose psychology when I got back from my 2 years, 2 years in Southeast Asia. And said, look, I've had this transformative experience. I don't care about money. I want to help people. So chose psychology at that point. Got about 2 or 3 years into a PhD program. Went straight from a bachelor's to a PhD. Started a PhD when I was 23 years old. Went straight to a PhD program. Got 2 or 3 years in and said, hey, wait a minute. I miss some of the things I grew up with. I felt ineffective as a therapist. I felt like I was taking my work home with me. I was very stressed out about, just sort of having to see people at their worst all the time and having some very sick clients. And so said, look, I love studying why people do the things that they do. I love thinking deeply about human behavior, but I think I want to look for a non-clinical setting to apply this study. And so, again, having grown up with that background, it was a very natural segue for me. And it's been, it's been a real gift, a real blessing, and a fantastic sort of intersection to work at. The intersection of mind and markets is fascinating.
No, that's brilliant. I mean, I have to go back a little bit because, stepping off doing your missionary work, I'm a big believer in the givers of this world always end up far more successful than the takers. So mindfulness is a big part of my life and NLP. So you going off to do that work is absolutely fantastic, Daniel.
Thank you.
So the time that you spent doing that work, doing the missionary work, was that your transition then to say, right, okay, I need to have that time to reflect on where I want to be as a young man?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Very difficult couple of years, growing up sort of an upper middle class suburban American, I was exposed to a lot of, a lot of things that I'd never seen before, but also grew up a lot, developed some really good habits, and just got a lot of perspective that hopefully has stayed with me to a greater or lesser extent. And so, yeah, that was a very transformative time for me. I had actually been a very poor student. I was sort of wasted some sort of God-given talents in middle school and high school. Got back from that missionary work, that 2-year period, with sort of renewed dedication to applying myself to doing something important with my life.
Yeah,
it was very transformative for me, for sure.
Excellent, excellent. So, I mean, as we all do sometimes, young men especially, we try to rebel against what's deemed to be norms, don't we? Until we have to find us, and then we find ourselves. So it's all part of the journey, isn't it?
It is, you know. And I was having fun in my punk band, and you know, had green hair and red hair and the whole lot.
Right.
So,
okay.
Yeah, changed a lot.
Right. So Green Day may have had an influence in your formative years then.
Big fan when I was a kid, yes.
Excellent. So when you went on to do your PhD, where did you start that, Daniel?
So I did my PhD at Brigham Young University, and then I did a postdoc at Emory University here in Atlanta.
Excellent. And what were the professors and the teachers and lecturers like? And were there anybody there that actually, you know, their teachings and learnings resonated with you?
You know, I think on the one hand, there's very little on the surface that I learned in my PhD that I apply in my daily work. I mean, to be very candid, to go from being a clinical psychologist to doing what I do now as an asset manager is so different in some respects. But I tell you what it did do. You know, when you're training to be a clinician, to be a therapist, you really, really have to break down walls and learn not to be defensive. You know, they'll videotape your sessions of working with clients. They play them back like they would a football player or a baseball player.
Yeah.
And you go over the tape and you say, look, this is where you messed up. This is what you could have done better.
Mm-hmm.
And at first you're very defensive and very protective of your work. And, you know, over time you learn to question your own ideas. And so while the content knowledge of the program has very little overlap with my current work, I would say the learning how to think, learning how to be self-critical, learning how to be non-defensive are huge assets to me as an investor.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I think that being self-effacing and critical is something that gives you psychological strength and resilience. Because the market, you know, has a habit of trying to make fools out of all of us, you know. So as an asset manager or a private investor, you have to be on your toes, as they say in the UK, all the while regarding what the market can throw at you.
Sure.
Excellent. So currently you're running your own business at Nocturne, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to talk about how that came into being, please.
Yeah, so Nocturne, you know, I've spent about 7 or 8 years now sort of in the behavioral finance space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a fantastic journey. And a lot of that time early on was spent going around and speaking to advisors, financial advisors, about how they could practically implement sort of the ivory tower, lofty academic findings of behavioral finance.
Yeah.
What was the so what of that for their practice? And I get a great deal of enjoyment out of that. I think there's a lot to be learned about how to apply behavioral finance to decision making and financial planning and things like that. But I said, wait a minute, we're still not applying the learnings of psychology to the way that we manage assets. And I thought that there was some valuable work to be done there that wasn't being done, whereas there was a lot of great work being done on this sort of self-management financial planning side. I thought there wasn't a great deal being done on applying psychology to sort of asset management in particular, and so decided to take that on as well. And the great thing about markets is they provide you such a rich source of data against which psychological phenomena play out. You know, whereas most sort of clinical psychologists are sort of left scrambling and trying to operationalize variables like happiness and things like this.
Yeah.
You know, market psychologists can tell, fairly real time. We have a data-driven, dynamic, crowdsourced metric of sentiment. And so it's a very neat place to work.
No, I would have to agree with that. I think sentiment these days, and also we can touch on it later on, the powers of the robots and electronic trading and ETFs and HFTs are a phenomenon that can drive big data, as they say now. And big data is going to be something that becomes more and more valuable as we go forward.
Mm.
Yeah. So with regards to investing then, Daniel, when did you first make your first purchase, your first stock in your own on your own book, that you you invested your own money, hard-earned cash?
Oh, it would have been, you know, very early. I mean, my parents would give me sort of birthday money and stuff from a very early age. In terms of my own money, I mean, I was, you know, I was saving and investing from the minute I made my first dollar. So, you know, right out of college, which for me, after a 2-year break for missionary work and 8 years of school, was, you know, I was probably 27. But,
27, okay.
So, yeah, I was probably 27. And it would have been remarkably, it would have been remarkably boring. I mean, it would have been sort of index funds and things like that. So that would have been my first purchase. Nothing too exciting.
Okay.
But,
so sorry.
But sound. Yeah, but sound, but not exciting.
Okay. And do you think you had that sort of methodology ingrained in you from your dad's influence about you know, long-term investing, the benefits of investing, so that you take a very conservative stance with your first plunge, sort of thing?
Well, I think, you know, the way that my dad operates, and I think in some respects I mirror the way that he invests. He takes sort of a core and satellite approach, I think, but he's pretty aggressive with the satellites. So he'll, you know, he says, look, you know, you got to cover what he calls daily bread. You got to sort of set aside the basics. You got to, you know, lock down, make sure your house is in order. But then once you get the basics covered, you can go and have a little more fun with it. So, I mean, he's quite an active stock picker, you know, once the fundamentals are out of the way. And so I'd say that I'm the same way. And so it's been fun for me to sort of get to a place financially where I could cover some of my bases and then get to apply some of the more interesting parts of market psychology to the way that I invest.
Excellent. So as an investor at the moment then, how would you describe yourself in a sense of, are you low risk, cautious, long-term investor?
You know, I think the way that I would describe myself, other people wouldn't describe me similarly. And I think it has to do with some sort of mistaken notions about how we define risk.
Okay.
So the way that we invest at Nocturne, we run what would be called, high conviction portfolios. So 25 stock portfolios. And for me, that is a low risk way to invest. You know, when I'm looking at value stocks with quality, you know, high measures of quality and momentum, and holding them in concentrated way, that to me is a very sensible way to invest.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people would look at that and go, "Well, that's awfully risky." But you know, if you look at the math. With even as few as 25 stocks, you get over 90% of the benefits of diversification. You diversify the preponderance of idiosyncratic risk. I think there's a lot more safety to be had in investing in high quality value issues with a little bit of a catalyst than there is in even, say, an index fund, especially when you're looking at valuations where they are right now. So I would classify myself as a low risk, a highly diversified investor, and I think that the conventional wisdom would say that that's not true of me, if that makes sense.
No, I understand that. Now, given your concentrated portfolio of say 25 stocks, what spread is there of that of U.S., overseas, emerging markets, etc.?
It totally depends. So I pull from the whole universe, and I have no preconceptions. I have no preconceptions about what percentage should be international or domestic. I just look at different criteria. I'm looking for great value, measures of safety. You know, I look at a lot of things like proper debt loads and bankruptcy risk, and even look at sort of internals with management. I look at quality, you know, issues of quality and return on invested capital. And then I look for a little bit of a catalyst in the form of price momentum. And then after that, it's all quantitative. I don't have any discretion. You know, that's one of the ways that I sort of try and get myself out of the way.
Yeah.
And so I have no preconceptions. And frankly, people don't believe this. I don't even look. I mean, I don't even know what I own right now. I just know. So I couldn't even tell you what percentage are foreign or domestic.
Yeah.
But I don't come with any preconceptions about what it should look like in terms of sector or country.
Right. I find that very, very intriguing, Daniel, because I think one of the problems nowadays is because obviously we've got access to the internet, we've got access to our accounts, they're mainly online. And I'm having these conversations on a regular basis with people that I mentor and coach, and they're looking at their accounts and portfolios and individual stocks on a daily, hourly basis, or whenever they get access to their phones. And they're almost looking at it, they're looking at it far too often. And you saying, well, I don't know what I've got and I don't know what percentages they are. That's very, very interesting, because I think people spend too much time watching the day-to-day movements of stocks.
It would kill me. I'm not strong enough. I mean, you know, it's again, back to the PhD. I have to know myself. I mean, I don't, yeah. In some respects, I don't have a great temperament. I'm not Warren Buffett. Like, I'm a little more of a worrier.
Yeah.
And so I don't have the temperament to look at this every day and be fine with it. And in fact, you know, when I do become aware of what I own from time to time, it's kind of makes my stomach turn. Because, you know, if you're a value investor, and I mean, if you're doing what you ought to do, there's always going to be a reason you can come up with for why you shouldn't own those shares. I mean, that's why they're cheap.
Yes.
So that's a firewall for me from making bad decisions.
I love that. I love that viewpoint. Thank you for sharing that. Now, what has been your greatest lesson that you've attained since you started investing, Daniel?
You know, I think the biggest lesson for me growing up again in sort of a long-term Buffett, Munger, Ben Graham type household in many respects, learning to embrace momentum has been a big boon for my business, and I think has improved the way that I think about markets. And I think, we kind of come through the ranks in investing, and we usually decamp into sort of the technical or the fundamental side. And, you know, we talk about, well, there's momentum folks and chartists, and then there's the fundamental deep value guys, and never the twain shall meet. And I think that learning to marry those things and see them both as sort of psychological phenomena has really improved my returns and just improved my game as an investment manager. So again, I don't think that those camps have a lot of affinity for each other. And I think learning to combine those two approaches has been a big benefit to me.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, that sits well with what you've just said, in the sense of Ben Graham's quote that the individual investor should act consistently as an investor and not a speculator.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. You'd agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you wouldn't find much. I mean, there's occasionally something from Graham or Buffett. You know, Buffett talks about beware geeks bearing formulas, and I am a geek with a formula, so I guess right. he's hit me there. But yeah, absolutely. And for me, I talk in the book about being a rules-based behavioral investor. I call it RBI investing. It's a baseball term, big baseball guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, being a rules-based behavioral investor means not knowing what you own, sticking to your knitting, being well-diversified. All those things, I think, speak to investing rather than speculation.
Absolutely. No, that's a very, very good point. Now, I'm going to come to your book now. Now, you've written this wonderful book, The Laws of Wealth, The Psychology and the Secret of Investing Success, and you've written that with Harriman House. And I have the privilege of holding a copy in front of me, which I've been reading over the last couple of weeks. And I just wanted to talk about the book, if I may, with you, and for you to share some of the brilliant insights that you've put into the book. But I wanted to give you an opportunity before I start going through some of the bits I've highlighted, for you to give our readers possibly a little summary of the book, The Laws of Wealth, and the Secret to Investing Success, if possible, Daniel.
Yeah, it's really two books, and if I had been smarter, I would have just waited and published two books. So it's really it's really two books. Part one of the book talks about sort of 10 commandments of investor behavior.
Yeah.
And so I wrote this, frankly, for financial advisors, well, and for end investors, because what I encourage financial advisors to do is just as surely as you have an investment policy statement that you sign that says, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Client, I'm going to manage your money thusly, and I'm going to adhere to these first principles when managing your money. That should be reciprocal. And the client should in turn have to sign sort of a behavioral policy statement that says, look, in exchange for, you know, all that you're doing, I'm going to agree not to make these stupid mistakes about being, you know, overactive and short term and neurotic and these sorts of things. And again, I don't know that I've convinced many advisors. I think they're just happy for the business, not looking to put another obstacle in their way. But I think advisors would be very wise to do this. So I wrote these first sort of 10 commandments to speak to end investors. If you could do these things, you could hang on to a lot more of your money. I mean, research, study after study shows that we give up anywhere from about a quarter to half of our returns to making poor decisions. And so if you could just do these 10 sort of simple things, you'd be far better off. Part two of the book is a little wonkier, is a little deeper read. Talks about, I try and pick on active and passive approaches and say, look, there's sort of this middle ground. I think active and passive management have behavioral chinks in the armor. So I think there's a better way to do it. And it talks about, it sort of sets forth a model of behavioral risk and says, look, this is where we make a lot of our mistakes. And then it tries to create an investment protocol that's robust to those mistakes.
Excellent summary. I'd like to go back, if I may, to the brilliant opening, if I can share this with the readers. Rule one, chapter title, love it. You control what matters most, and your opening gambit is the quote from Benjamin Graham. The investor's chief problem, and even his worst enemy, is likely to be himself.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I get called on not infrequently by friends of mine who are not clients, who just want some sort of basic, basic investing advice. And it feels so big to them. It feels so incomprehensible and so out of their control. And so I was very intentional about putting this first and saying, look, you know, Mrs. Investor, the number one thing that you can do to improve your returns, it is in your hands. It's not Brexit. It's not what Janet Yellen decides. It's not the disastrous next president of America. It's none of these things. It's in your hands, and it's you doing the blocking and tackling of being a good investor. So I wanted right out of the gate to empower people, and then also give them a sense of how much they're giving up. I can't remember if it's in that chapter or another, but I talk about the best performing mutual fund of the early aughts. So from 2000 to 2010, this focus fund got 18% a year, 18% a year returns. Incredible. You know, bested its best, its next competitor by over 300 basis points per year. And the average investor in the fund had a realized gain of negative 11%. So even if you can pick the greatest managers in the world, and you can't, but even if you could, it's still all down to you. It's still all down to you making good decisions, because you could find the next Warren Buffett and be worse off for your own behavior.
No, that's a very, very excellent point there. And one of the several great quotes you've written in here, and lines that I've highlighted here. And this is about individuals. And I think, given what, like you've just touched on, you know, Janet Yellen, Obama's going. We've got Trump. We've had Brexit. We're having votes all over Europe regarding different governments and what they're going to do next. And you touched on the fact that. This is a brilliant line that you've written here, Daniel. The average adult spends about one of every 8 hours contemplating the future.
Yeah. For me, it's about four of every 8 hours, which is why I don't look at my stock.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we think so much about the future, but we have such an impoverished ability to forecast it.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the rules based investing. Because if you think about this year, and we've had such a nice year in the market, and there's no good reason.
There's no good reason. It's climbed the wall of worry, hasn't it, essentially?
Oh, it has. I mean, it has. I mean, if you look at, you know, and then the two big boons to the market this year have been Brexit and the unexpected U.S. election. And nobody in the world, nobody predicted that it would happen. And then once it happened, no one predicted that it would be positive for markets. And so, you have to follow the rules. You can't worry about the future. You just have to do all you can with what the present gives you.
Exactly, and I don't want to give too much away. I feel like I'm giving the book away here with things I'm pulling out. But your research quoted contrarian investor David Drummond, who found that most of Wall Street, 59% of Wall Street consensus forecasts, missed their targets by gaps so large as to make the results unusable.
Yeah. So he has so much great research in there. The one David Drummond quote in the book found that they looked at 78,000 consensus forecasts and found that one time in 170 were they within 5% of the eventual outcome that had been predicted. I mean, it's just worthless. And I said this to a crowd of investment analysts recently. I'm like, look, if you guys all walked into the ocean, like the world would be no better, no worse off. Like,
oh, that's harsh. That is harsh.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's true. We just don't need it, and no one knows what's going on. And it's this gigantic industry. And you know what though? They're selling something we have a psychological need for, because you know, people read statistics like this and go, well, if they're so bad at this, mm-hmm. then why are they around?
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, their existence, sort of is self-perpetuating and sort of justifies that they're good at their job. And I think the reason that they're still around is because we spend one in 8 hours thinking about the future, and we want some salve, right? We want some...
Yes.
We want to solve for our worry about the future, and they give us that, but it's counterfeit. I mean, there's nothing to it.
Okie dokie. So, I mean, equal to that, all right, the forecasters are getting it wrong. However, you're a big advocate for private individuals, essentially, to seek advice. And your second rule is that, you know, you can't do it alone. There is a role for advisors, and you're looking to seek outperformance, and you'll get a better chance of that by seeking advice.
Yeah. So, you know, I see a financial advisor and a Wall Street analyst as being very, you know, very different animals, to be clear. And again, I talk in the book about how to pick a good advisor, because all advisors are certainly not created equal. But, you know, the point that I try and make there in chapter two, that you cannot do this alone, the basic point of that chapter is you need a financial advisor, but not for the reason that you think. You know, most people think that when they're going to a financial advisor, they're getting, you know, financial advice.
Yeah.
But basically what you're getting, if you're getting the most value out of that advisor, is you're getting a behavioral coach. Because if that person can keep you from making four or five big time mistakes over the course of your lifetime, they've done exceptionally well. They've more than earned their money. And so research from Vanguard, Morningstar, InvestNet, Aon Hewitt all shows that people who work with advisors outperform those who don't pretty sizably by about 2-3% a year, and that those effects compound over time, so that people who work with an advisor end up having 200-300% more money than those who do not. And it's not because they're great at picking stocks. I mean, it's because they keep you from making dumb mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, the essence of the first 10 chapters, really, for me, is about applying the principles of behavioral finance to almost everything, to life in general, risk management, and then a selection process towards stocks. And then, as you say, make those decisions, stick to your knitting, and then almost forget about it. And I think that's the hardest part for people, because they, like as you say, they worry, don't they? So it's hard to just adhere to the plan, stick to the plan almost.
Yeah, and you know, I like the point that you made about these things applying to life, because I think that they do, and it's my hope that people who read this book, even though it's ostensibly a finance investing book, I hope that they'll find application for these things elsewhere in life. Because, you know, money, it's funny for me to say this as a guy who talks and thinks about money all the time, but, you know, money is necessary but not sufficient to have a good life. And it's really sort of, you know, part of what I like about what I've set forth in the book is it sort of puts money in its proper place. Like, look, there's, you know, there's bigger, more important things to do than worry about these things once you've got some of your bases covered. So I hope that this book helps people do worry about things that matter a lot more than money.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that a bit later on in the conversation, but what your primary hope is for readers as the main takeaway of the book. I think you may have covered that essentially, but in a sense of your I get the impression, and I hope I'm right in my assessment of the book, is that you're trying to empower readers to make A, less mistakes, B, empowered, know how to approach their financial advisors in a sense of not going there like our parents used to do in the 40s and 50s to the doctors, and whatever the doctor said, we went, okay, you know.
Right.
So we tend to challenge them and basically get the best we can out of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if it empowers people, I'll be thrilled. And I think it also, you know, it also, I try to demystify it. You know, empower and demystify might be the two words I'd use to describe it. Because, you know, people think that you have to be some quantitative wizard to do well in the market. And a lot of what you need is, you know, sort of a basic knowledge and then some behavioral restraint, and you'll do quite well. And so hopefully this book provides at least the knowledge. You have to supply the restraint, I guess.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. Now, Daniel, there is something you touched on, and as being a contrarian, I have to agree with you. You know, there's no bias there at all. But rule three in your chapter, you say trouble is opportunity, and the essence of maximum pessimism. You know, Sir John Templeton's famous quote.
Yeah. John Temple, Sir John is a Tennessean. I'm from Alabama, live in Georgia. So always love to highlight a great Southerner like Sir John. So, number three is one of these things that it's easy to say, hard to do. And I think that could be said of most of the book. It's simple, but not easy.
Yeah.
So everybody knows this. You know, I mean, I sat by someone on a plane recently, and they're like, oh, you know, tell me, you know, what do you do? And I told them, and they go, oh, well, you needed to go to 8 years of school to tell me to buy low, sell high. You know? And so everybody knows to do this. And the research shows that nearly no one does it, including fund managers. I mean, you know, I cite research in the book that talks about fund managers having their highest cash positions typically when valuations are most attractive and being most heavily levered when things are most frothy. And so, you know, part of chapter three is about setting forth some research that shows this is the case, which isn't, you know, exactly groundbreaking. But then I think the bigger piece of it is talking about implementing systems in part two. Implementing systems that concretize this behavior and make it law, because you're basically never going to do it when you're in the moment. You know, a lot of what I try, a lot of what I sort of devilishly try and do in the book is erode people's notions of free will. I mean, you know, I talk in the book, you know, about basically, you know, the first part of being a good behavioral investor is realizing that you're just as stupid as the next person.
Yeah.
You know, you're just as flawed and irrational. I cite research in the book that shows that we tend to lose 13% of our IQ under duress, on, you know, when we're stressed out.
Yeah.
And so it's less about understanding that, you know, you should buy low and sell high. And it has everything to do with creating a system that makes that law.
Excellent. And I would agree with that as well. I mean, we saw that with Brexit, and we saw that with the Trump victory. You know, Brexit, the market, just even all the fund managers were selling stuff left, right and center. And then the morning of the victory towards Trump almost being announced, markets were down 6, 7, 8% globally. And then the minute he came out and gave a conciliatory speech, the market started to rise, and they haven't looked back since, purely on rhetoric. So it's like headless chickens around the world almost.
No, it's wild. I mean, I couldn't have been more wrong about that. And it's just a further, I mean, I tweeted, oh, this is terrible. I shouldn't tell people this. I'll get no investors ever. So I tweeted, I think the day or two before the US election, I tweeted, Hillary Clinton's going to win by 100, and anyone that's telling you otherwise is selling you something. I mean, this is like, I couldn't see a path to victory for Trump.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was supported by the best thinking and the best research we had at the time,
yeah.
Which just goes to show you why I'm glad that I don't manage money based on my own bad ideas. You know,
yeah.
If I had been going off my forecast or what I thought was going to happen, I would have done a lot worse than I did by following my own rules.
Well, I think that's very honest and clear of you, Daniel, in the sense of, you know, you have your own personal thinking, you've got your own personal research, but you separate that from your business and what you do with your clients. And that's very, very commendable, I think.
Yeah, I'm just not smart enough to do otherwise, I guess.
So given that the process is in the book, I'm thinking now, you've identified, and I'd like you to just share really what you think are the best strategies to enable investors to make less poor decisions driven by their own psychology. Because, I mean, I've asked people several questions. What level of percentage would you put on regarding importance of mastering your psychology? Some have said 90%, some have said 80%. What would you say, Daniel?
Oh, I mean, I have a hammer, so everything's a nail. I would say it's everything, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a keen interest in that being a big deal. That keeps my kids fed.
Yeah, of course, of course. So it's way up there. So you're going to say in the 90s?
In the 90s, yes, yes. You know, the funny thing about investing is there's such a quick point of diminishing returns. I mean, you could read 5 or 10 good books on investing and get, 95% of all you ever needed to know about investing, and the rest would be behavior. I mean, you can't say that about many things, that you could read, a handful of books and know everything you need to know. And then people like me who spend the rest of their life in the discipline maybe get to 97% with an extra 30 years. And so, after you've read those 4 or 5 books, and The Laws of Wealth is certainly one of them. Once you've read those 4 or 5 books, I mean, you're sort of, it's all implementation after that. It's all behavior.
Yeah, it's all about discipline. Now, you touched on the 4 C's of rule-based behavioral investing in this almost the second half of the book. And you've earmarked and consistency, clarity, courageousness, conviction. Now, could you just give a very brief synopsis on those four headline 4 C's, please?
Sure. So consistency is just being rules-based. So I do a lot to sort of erode our notions of our own intelligence and free will in the book and show a study. It's a meta-analysis, which means a study of all the studies. Shows that when we look at over 200 studies, expert discretion is beaten or matched by simple rules 94% of the time. I mean, I'm a rules-based investor because it allows me to offer my products more cheaply and in a more favorable way. So I think being a behavioral investor means being a rules-based investor. The second one is clarity. I cite in there that the Fed, who has a big announcement today, presumably, the Fed releases 45,000 pieces of economic data each year. And there's just no way to make sense of it. I mean, we have limits to sort of what we can process. And guess what? The secret to the market is not the Baltic Dry Goods Index, So I talk in the clarity portion about just looking at a handful of things that matter. For me, that's price, quality, momentum, these sorts of things, whatever that is for you. And there's many ways to be a successful investor. You just really need to look at a clear, handful or less of sort of important things. The next piece I talk about is courageousness, which has sort of two parts. Courageousness, I think, basically means being fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. But then again, with that consistency thing, automating that process. And then finally, and I think this is one of the biggest improvements that could be made to the active fund management industry, is conviction. You know, I share, which means, again, for me, that's a 25-stock portfolio that looks different depending on what sort of asset class you're managing or how you think about the world. But the principle remains that you should either be a low-cost passive investor or you should be a high conviction investor. You should never be caught in the middle. And that's so many investors in the U.S. I think the U.K. is making laws that are making this harder to do. But 3/4 of what are marketed and priced as active funds in the U.S. don't differ meaningfully from their benchmarks. So if you want to be a passive investor, go get it from BlackRock for, you know, 0.06%.
Yeah.
Don't pay some fund manager in New York millions of dollars a year to hold 300 stocks and not look that different than an index fund. And so, I talk a great deal about that in the book, about, look, you know, there's many ways to skin this cat, but never be caught in a low conviction, high cost fund.
No, I think you touch on that a bit more so later on in the book as well, under the 5 P's of equity investing. And you've got a great quote. I love the fact you open most chapters with your quotes as well, because I love my quotes. All models are wrong, but some models are useful. By George E.P. Box. Brilliant quote. I've never seen that one before, by the way, Daniel, so well found.
Yeah, well, and, you know, people, as I was at a seminar recently, at a hedge fund seminar, and I, you know, the guy raises his hand afterwards and says, like, well, how can you be sure that this is, you know, that your model is always going to outperform and that you're always going to pick the best stocks? And I was like, oh, like, no, like, you haven't been listening. Like, I'm not sure at all. You know, I'm not sure at all. This is guaranteed to underperform, from time to time.
Yeah.
But I have every confidence. For me, being a rules-based investor is about tilting probability in your favor. And if you tilt probability in your favor in a way that's both humble and convicted at the same time, and
indeed,
many people can't get their head around that.
Yeah.
If you tilt probability in your favor over time, you're going to win. But, you know, this doesn't mean again, we will just give away the whole book now. No one needs to buy. There's a story. No, it's fine. There's a story in the book that talks about a baseball executive who's playing blackjack, and his friend has 19. And his friend is drunk and he wants to hit, you know, he wants another card when he's holding 19. And, you know, this baseball executive is like, man, you're crazy. Like, you can't hit with 19 when you need 21. The odds are against you, you know, massively. And so the drunk guy says, no, hit me. The dealer turns it over and it's a 2. And you know, and this baseball executive tries to make the point, you know, his friend says, oh, I was right, you were wrong. And he goes, no, you can be right and still be a moron. Right.
Yes.
So, I will be wrong sometimes, but I will never be a moron. And I think that's sort of the crux of my approach. Doesn't mean I'll never underperform. Doesn't mean I'll never have a bad year. But I'll never be a moron. And yeah, that's an important distinction.
I think the great thing about that quote that you've just said, and you know, I don't often use the word moron, but I think, you know, that's suitable for that's accessible for you to use, is the fact that all the great fund managers, and you've touched on it, you reiterated it just now, underperform at some point. It's about the longevity of their performance and not having great drawdowns and having years where they implode because they finally cave in and they don't have the resilience not to follow the herd. And you know, I know you touch on herding in the book, but great fund managers and great investors, they have taken time to find their own strategies and learn the strategies and have got the best advice. And what they tend to do is just sit and do nothing. And the hardest part is to do nothing and not follow the herd and cave in and give up your resolve and say, you know what, like Buffett in the 2000s, he was saying, or prior to the 2000s, I'm not going to get into tech in the 90s. I don't understand it, right? And he ignored it all. And then the boom happened and he got so much grief, didn't he? And then when it pops, he was like, okay, that's the reason why I didn't get in. I didn't understand the valuation of these tech stocks. So it's about having that resolve to just do your own thing sometimes.
Yeah, I suggest in the book that fund managers should work 4 days a year, 4 days a year. And I really do believe it. And I mean, no one's going to take me up on this, but I really do believe that fund managers should work. I mean, very, very, very little. Most of what you should do is sort of fundamental research about setting up a model. And then you should kind of leave it alone. Go see a movie.
Well, we have a fund manager like that. You know, he runs his name is names escapes me now. A significant fund manager who basically has bought his stocks and has sits and has sat still ever since and not really done much with it. And for some reason, my brain's just gone into meltdown. And I can't think what the fund is called now. But I'll come back to that a little later on. But going back, Fundsmith, the emerging equities fund. Yeah, have you heard of that in the UK?
And I'm not aware of it now.
Yeah, and he's basically bought the, and his resolve is to keep everything low cost, and not to churn the fund whatsoever. So he that's what he does with it with that particular fund. So that's done exceptionally well over the years for him. So on the, going back to the five P's, Daniel: price, property, pitfalls, people, push. Now, I wanted to touch on the pitfalls because we're trying to educate people. So I wanted to just very briefly just touch on the pitfalls for me and why people should avoid pitfalls of certain strategies.
Yeah, so we tend to, it's our human nature to look for reasons why a stock's going to do well rather than to sort of think of reasons why it won't do well. You know, I mean, it's this optimism bias, it's confirmation bias. We look for reasons we're right. We have a very hard time looking for reasons we're wrong. Yeah. And if we go back to our blackjack example, your first duty of loyalty as an investor is to do no harm. I mean, this is just like a doctor, like a new doctor taking the oath. Your first duty is to do no harm. And so, you know, you look at something like the value premium. So I'm going to mess up the exact numbers, but you know, value has outperformed dramatically over long periods of time. But about half of value stocks underperform. Like when you slice things into deciles, right? So if you took the highest decile of cheapest stocks and invested in those every year, get the cheapest stocks and did that for 30 years, you would have done very well. But about half of those stocks are really crummy and really do go on to underperform, and they're cheap for a reason. So I try and pair price, which is value, with pitfalls, which is risk management techniques that I talk about in the book, and say, look, if you can sift out some of the crummy ones, that are cheap for a reason, I mean, the market's imperfect, but it's not crazy. I mean, sometimes something's cheap for a reason. I'm just a big believer that your first duty of loyalty is to protect those assets, to guard against permanent loss of capital. And that's one of the best ways that you can do that.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that, Daniel. Thank you for that. Now, the person I was talking about, Daniel, is a very famous fund manager, asset manager in the UK. His name is Terry Smith. And his fund or his management is called Fundsmith. And essentially what he's saying is that there's no fees per performance. There's no nonsense. There's no shorting. There's no market timing. I'm basically going to buy these stocks, these high quality stocks. I've got high conviction on them. I'm going to have a small number of stocks and I'm going to be holding them until something goes completely wrong with these stocks. And he's outperformed majority of his peers since he started up the fund by just being consistently with these stocks, ignored the markets essentially, and like you say, he's bought the stocks and he's just forgotten about them essentially.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's perfectly right, but it's hard to do because I get called all the time. I mean, I get called all the time by news outlets who want an opinion on something, and I've been on TV a few times. I barely get on TV because every time they call, they go, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I could tell you what I'm doing, but I could in no wise tell you what's going to happen. And so, you know, the TV spots go to the people willing to take a big guess.
Yes.
Oh,
dear. I mean, Daniel, what I'm enjoying about this, because I'm a big fan of psychology, and you've essentially researched it and studied it, and you've made a career of it. And what I find important and the essence of all of this is the fact that so few people put the level of importance on behavioral finance and psychology as you do or have done. And I think if we can do one thing right today, is to ensure that when this podcast goes out, we get as many people listening to it as possible, because we need to ensure that they preserve their wealth and they take in lessons that you've put in together in this book, and they actually go out and purchase this book.
Yeah, I mean, I of course hope that that's the case. And and I will also say, though, you know, I don't mean to be dismal here at Christmas time, but, you know, one thing that I will say, one reason that I believe in a rules-based behavioral approach to investing is it's so hard to do what's right. I mean, if you look at the U.S., you know, it's a fat country, right? If you look at the U.S., we started labeling our food in 1990. We sort of had these comprehensive nutrition labels on the side of food. So just factually, you know exactly what you're getting. Right. So that's sort of the data driven factual part.
Yeah.
We've known since 1990 what's good for you, what's not. Right.
Yeah.
The U.S. at the time had no state in 1990 where over 14% of the residents were obese. Now we have no state where there's under 19% obesity, and two states, including my home state of Alabama, have 35% or greater obesity. And this is sort of a microcosm of investing. You can know the right thing to do. You can know all of the right facts, but you know, in a moment of weakness, the cinnamon bun still tastes better than the salad.
You know, so, absolutely.
Yes, everyone go by the laws of wealth, but do understand that it's the nutrition label, and you've still got to do the hard work. It will tell you all the facts, but you've still got to do the hard work.
Yeah, it's that thing about discipline, and you know, I'm at my greatest weakness now, you know, the month of December heading towards Christmas, because we have what we call in the UK mince pies. I'm not sure what you call them in the US.
Yeah, we call them nothing. We don't have them. But I was just in Ireland where I had a mince pie.
Yeah,
so quite good.
I'll be eating them every day until New Year's Day. That's my weakness. And I'm like, I look at them, I think, these are not good for you, Peter. But I'm still having another one, you know, and I'll be having another one tomorrow. And it's like, oh, but yeah, thank you for that, Daniel. Great book. Now, I've got two more questions for you, Daniel. One's about, if you were starting out today, what would you do that you'd not considered or unable to do when you first started, please?
What would I do if I were starting out today?
Mm-hmm.
I think I would be more bold.
Okay.
People reward boldness, and I think you're hearing that in our talk today. People reward boldness. We have a story to tell, and right now we're being drowned out by know-nothings in pinstripe suits, right?
Yes.
And so I would be bolder in stating the things that I know to be the truth. I think that's sort of my goal for next year. I feel like a lot of, you know, a lot of folks who work in behavioral finance are academics, of course, and there's a gray area. There's a tentativeness and an uncertainty that comes with being an academic. But I think we can say some things more boldly, even if what we're saying is we don't know.
No, I understand what you're saying there. Now, Daniel, you've touched on a couple of books, but I want you to just share with our readers, other than your brilliant book, are there other books that you would highly recommend for some of our listeners to purchase and have a read of, please?
Oh, there's a ton. And, you know, a shameless plug here, I've actually created a book list because I get asked this question so much. So if you just Google Nocturne Capital Reading List, I've got 15 or 20. But just off the top of my head, What Works on Wall Street by Jim O'Shaughnessy is a classic that's informed a lot of what I do. Of course, the Ben Graham books, Intelligent Investor is great. Wes Gray at Alpha Architect. The name of his firm is Alpha Architect, but he has a book called Quantitative Value and a book called Quantitative Momentum that are just fantastic. So those off the top of my head. Oh, and of course, Thinking Fast and Slow is by Daniel Kahneman, is the Bible of behavioral economics. So those four, but I've got about 20, and I've broken them out by sort of subgenre on my website.
Brilliant. Well, what I'll do when I publish this, Daniel, is I'll add that link to the article when we publish it. Okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Now, Daniel, I've covered all my questions, but I wanted to ask one last cheeky one. When and if will you be in the UK next? And I'm thinking, you know, maybe to catch up, have a discussion, see you eye to eye. Have you got plans to visit us in Blighty?
So Ireland has done a better job of recognizing my talent than this. I've been to Ireland a few times this year, and we'll be back next year. So I did a seminar for the CFA, the UK CFA Society. And I'm hopeful that podcasts like this will pique the interest of some folks who will get me over there.
Right. I'll have discussions with the people that I know. You have discussions with the people that you know, and we'll get you over in the UK next year, Daniel.
We will make it happen. It's beautiful.
Excellent. Okay. Daniel, thank you ever so much. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for your great insights and your brilliant book. I look forward to speaking with you again and seeing you in the flesh in 2017.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care and God bless. That was Dr. Daniel Crosby with us from the USA. Thank you, Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.